I spent evenings studying in hotel rooms across America and at my kitchen table. By the end, I knew my opponent's positions inside and out, in some cases better than they did. We held most of our debate prep sessions at the Doral Arrowwood, a hotel near my home in Westchester County. We were joined by more people from my team, campaign consultants Joel Benenson, Mandy Grunewald, and Jim Margolis, Tony Kark, our head of research and an Obama debate prep veteran, and Bob Barnett, who had helped prepare Democratic candidates for debates since Walter Mondale. We would gather at noon and work late into the evening. We'd practice specific exchanges, fine-tune answers, and try to plan out dramatic moments that would help shape the coverage of the debate, although often the most important clashes are the hardest to predict. The hotel would supply us with a smorgasbord that they'd replenish throughout the day: sandwiches, salads, fruit, bagels, and chicken soup. They also had a freezer full of Oreo ice cream bars that we kept emptying and they kept refilling. Anytime you looked around the room, you'd see someone holding one or the stick and wrapper on the table in front of them. Debate prep helped me get ready emotionally for some of the most consequential moments of the campaign. A presidential debate is theater. It's a boxing match. It's high-stakes surgery. Pick your metaphor. One wrong move, one roll of the eye or slip of the tongue can spell defeat. In debate prep, I practice keeping my cool while my staff fired hard questions at me. They'd misrepresent my record. They'd impugn my character. Sometimes I'd snap back and feel better for getting it off my chest. I'd think to myself, now that I've done that here, I don't have to do it on live TV. It worked. I remember becoming frustrated with my team's advice at one point. I couldn't quite understand how they were recommending I handle a potentially contentious exchange with Bernie. Finally, I said to Jake, who had been peppering me with questions and grimacing at my answers, "Just show me. You do it." So he became me, and I took on the role of attack dog against myself. It was a truly surreal experience. Finally, he mock pleaded for mercy. "You're right, you're right. Do it your way." Then there was Philippe as Trump. That was a sight to see. The first time I walked into the room for a prep session with him, he was already at the podium, staring at the distant wall and refusing to make eye contact with me. "Oh, God, he's ready to be obnoxious," I said. None of us had any idea. Philippe took his character study very seriously, including the physicality. Trump looms and lurks on a debate stage. So Philippe did too, always hanging out on the edge of my peripheral vision. He wore a suit like Trump's, a little baggy, a tie like Trump's, way too long, and actual Trump brand cufflinks and a Trump brand watch he found on eBay. He wore 3.5-inch shoe heighteners, flailed his arms like Trump, shrugged and mugged like Trump. I didn't know whether to applaud or fire him. The weeks that Philippe spent studying tapes of Trump in the Republican debates paid off. He knew how Trump's mind worked, how a question about Social Security would take Trump on a twisted journey into government waste, undocumented immigrants, and terrorism, always terrorism. He would say the craziest things, which I know Philippe is capable of doing all on his own, but he made clear to us from that first day that 90% of what he'd say was straight from the horse's mouth, with the remaining 10% being his best guess as to what Trump would say. I never knew which was which. In the end, Trump hardly said a thing in any of the debates that I was hearing for the first time. It quickly became evident that our normal debate prep wouldn't work this time. Trump wouldn't answer any question directly. He was rarely linear in his thinking or speaking. He digressed into nonsense and then digressed even more. There was no point in refuting his arguments like a normal debate. It was almost impossible to identify what his arguments even were, especially since they changed minute to minute. Winning, we realized, would mean hitting hard, since he couldn't bear it. Staying cool, since he often resorted to viciousness when cornered. Throwing his own words back at him, since he couldn't stand hearing them, and making my own arguments with clarity and precision, since he couldn't do the same for himself. At our last practice before the first debate, I walked in to find Philippe as Trump and Ron as me practicing the opening handshake. They were half-joking, but Philippe had raised the issue that, unlike two men debating who just meet in the middle and shake hands, there was a question of whether Trump would try to hug or, dare I say it, kiss me. Not out of affinity or chivalry, but rather to create a moment where he would tower over me, making it clear he was a guy and I was a girl. Fair enough, I said, let's practice. Philippe came at me with his arms outstretched. I tried to stiff-arm him and get away. It ended with him literally chasing me across the room, putting me in a bear hug and kissing the back of my head. What can I say? We were committed. If you haven't seen it, it's worth pulling up on YouTube. It stopped being funny when we saw the Access Hollywood tape. I was not going to shake that man's hand. When we came on stage in the actual debate, I think my body language made it pretty clear he should stay away, and he did. But throughout that debate, which was town hall style, meaning we weren't confined to standing at podiums and could walk around the stage, Trump stalked and lurked. Philippe had done the same thing during prep. Several times a session, and we had 21 of them in the general, just as he had warned, Philippe S. Trump would say something so outlandish, none of us could quite believe it. Then he'd tell us it was almost verbatim from a Trump rally, interview, or primary debate. One day, Philippe S. Trump started complaining about how the mic guy screwed up, and the mic guy shouldn't get paid. We were totally confused, but kept going. When the 90-minute session was over, I asked, who is Mike? It turns out he was saying, Mike guy. Philippe explained that on two occasions, Trump had blamed the microphone for bad audio and said the contractor shouldn't get paid. After his dismal performance in the first debate, Trump really did say it was because his mic had been sabotaged. Philippe had called it. In the end, thanks to our practice sessions, I felt that deep sense of confidence that comes with rigorous preparation. Like accepting the nomination, these debates were a first for me. The pressure you feel when you're about to walk on stage is almost unbearable. Almost, but not quite. You bear it by working hard to get ready. You bear it by having good people by your side. You bear it by not just hoping, but knowing you can handle a lot, because you already have. At least, that's what always worked for me. No matter how I spent the day, or where in the country I happened to be, I always called Bill before falling asleep. We'd catch each other up on the latest news about the election or what was happening with our family and friends. Sometimes we vented frustrations about how the campaign was going. Then we'd take a moment to figure out when we'd see each other next and say goodnight. I'd fall asleep feeling calmer and wake up in the morning with new energy and a list of new ideas to pursue. Even on the hardest days, those conversations kept me grounded and at peace. It is hard to be a woman. You must think like a man, act like a lady, look like a young girl, and work like a horse. A sign that hangs in my house. Sisterhood. Above all, be the heroine of your life, not the victim. Nora Ephron. On Being a Woman in Politics. In these pages, I put to paper years' worth of frustration about the tightrope that I and other women have had to walk in order to participate in American politics. I have a lot to say. I could fill an entire book, and not all of it is upbeat or even tempered. But there is joy and pride to be found in this chapter, too. My experiences as a woman in politics have been complex and disappointing at times, but ultimately rewarding beyond measure. In politics, the personal narrative is vital. My husband had a powerful story to tell. He lived for a while on a farm with no indoor plumbing. His father died before he was born. He stopped his stepfather from beating his mother. He became the first in his family to go to college. Barack Obama had a powerful story to tell. He was raised by his teenage mom and grandparents. His father was Kenyan. He spent part of his childhood living in Indonesia and grew up to become a community organizer and law professor whose story could have been written only in America. Few people would say that my story was quite so dazzling. I grew up in a white middle-class family in Park Ridge, a suburb of Chicago. My dad served during World War II and left every morning for his small business in the city, along with all the other fathers in our neighborhood heading to their jobs. My mom stayed at home to take care of my brothers, Hugh and Tony, and me, like all the mothers in our neighborhood. And my life looked like the lives of all the girls I knew. We attended excellent public or parochial schools, where first-rate teachers had high expectations for us. I went to our local Methodist church for Sunday services and youth activities all week long. I was a Brownie, then a Girl Scout. I got my first job when I was 13, working at a park 3 mornings a week. My hangouts were everyone's hangouts: the public library, the local movie theater, swimming pools, skating rinks. My family watched TV together at night. When the Beatles performed for the first time on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, my friends and I gathered together around the screen, alternately, silently, captivated, and shrieking with glee. It's a story that many would consider perfectly ordinary. Don't get me wrong. I loved my childhood, and every year that passes, I appreciate more how hard my parents worked to give it to me. But my story, or at least how I've always told it, was never the kind of narrative that made everyone sit up and take notice. We yearn for that show-stopping tale, that one-sentence pitch that captures something magical about America, that hooks you and won't let go. Mine wasn't it. Yet there is another story of my life, one that I believe is as inspiring as any other. I wish I had claimed it more publicly and told it more proudly. It's the story of a revolution. I was born right when everything was changing for women. Families were changing, jobs were changing, laws were changing. Views about women that had governed our lives for millennia were changing, finally. I came along at just the right moment, like a surfer catching the perfect wave. Everything I am, everything I've done, so much of what I stand for, flows from that happy accident of fate. The fact that the women's movement happened alongside the civil rights movement indeed was entwined with it in many ways, compelling America to reckon with entrenched notions of human value and opening doors of opportunity that had previously been sealed shut to millions, made it that much more thrilling and meaningful. I know that for a lot of people, including a lot of women, the movement for women's equality exists largely in the past. They're wrong about that. It's still happening, still as urgent and vital as ever. And it was and is the story of my life, mine and millions of other women's. We share it. We wrote it together. We're still writing it. And even though this sounds like bragging, and bragging isn't something women are supposed to do, I haven't just been a participant in this revolution. I've helped lead it. I was one of just 27 women out of 235 students in my class at Yale Law School, the first woman partner at the oldest law firm in Arkansas, the first woman to chair the National Board of the Legal Services Corporation, The person who declared on the world stage that human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights. The first lady to be elected to public office. The first woman senator from New York. In fact, for a few weeks, I was both. By a quirk of the calendar, I was sworn in before Bill left office. And I was the first woman to be nominated for president by a major political party and win the national popular vote. I never figured out how to tell this story right. Partly that's because I'm not great at talking about myself. Also, I didn't want people to see me as the, quote, woman candidate, unquote, which I find limiting, but rather as the best candidate whose experience as a woman in a male-dominated culture made her sharper, tougher, and more competent. That's a hard distinction to draw, and I wasn't confident that I had the dexterity to pull it off. But the biggest reason I shied away from embracing this narrative is that storytelling requires a receptive audience, and I've never felt like the American electorate was receptive to this one. I wish so badly we were a country where a candidate who said, "My story is the story of a life shaped by and devoted to the movement for women's liberation," would be cheered, not jeered. But that's not who we are, not yet. Maybe it's because we take this story for granted. Yeah, the women's movement happened. Why are we still talking about it? Maybe it's too female. Maybe it's at once too big, a sweeping historical shift, and too small, just another middle-class Midwestern girl finding her way in the world. But I do think it's special. It's not a typical political narrative, but it's mine. This has to be said. Sexism and misogyny played a role in the 2016 presidential election. Exhibit A is that the flagrantly sexist candidate won. A whole lot of people listened to the tape of him bragging about sexually assaulting women, shrugged, and said, "He still gets my vote." But Donald Trump didn't invent sexism, and its impact on our politics goes far beyond this one election. It's like a planet that astronomers haven't precisely located yet, but know exists because they can see its impact on other planets' orbits and gravities. Sexism exerts its pull on our politics and our society every day in ways both subtle and crystal clear. A note here on terminology. Others might have a different view, but here's how I see the distinction between sexism and misogyny. When a husband tells his wife, "I can't quite explain why, and I don't even like admitting this, but I don't want you to make more money than me, so please don't take that amazing job offer." That's sexism. He could still love her deeply and be a great partner in countless ways, but he holds tight to an idea that even he knows isn't fair about how successful a woman is allowed to be. Sexism is all the big and little ways that society draws a box around women and says, "You stay in there. Don't complain because nice girls don't do that. Don't try to be something women shouldn't be. Don't wear that. Don't go there. Don't think that. Don't earn too much. It's not right somehow. We can't explain why. Stop asking." We can all buy into sexism from time to time, often without even noticing it. Most of us try to keep an eye out for those moments and avoid them, or when we do misstep, apologize and do better next time. Misogyny is something darker. It's rage, disgust, hatred. It's what happens when a woman turns down a guy at a bar and he switches from charming to scary. Or when a woman gets a job that a man wanted and instead of shaking her hand and wishing her well, he calls her a bitch and vows to do everything he can to make sure she fails. Both sexism and misogyny are endemic in America. If you need convincing, just look at the YouTube comments or Twitter replies when a woman dares to voice a political opinion, or even just share an anecdote from her own lived experience. People hiding in the shadows step forward just far enough to rip her apart. Sexism in particular can be so pervasive we stop seeing it. It reminds me of the opening anecdote from author David Foster Wallace's 2005 commencement speech at Kenyon College. Two young fish are swimming along. They meet an older fish swimming the other way who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys. How's the water?" The two young fish swim on for a bit until one looks at the other and asks, "What's water?" In other words, Wallace said, the most obvious realities are often the ones that are the hardest to see and talk about. I'd say that sums up the problem of recognizing sexism, especially when it comes to politics, quite nicely. It's not easy to be a woman in politics. That's an understatement. It can be excruciating, humiliating. The moment a woman steps forward and says, "I'm running for office," it begins. The analysis of her face, her body, her voice, her demeanor, the diminishment of her stature, her ideas, her accomplishments, her integrity. It can be unbelievably cruel. I hesitate to write this because I know that women who should run for office might hear it and say, "No thanks." And I passionately believe that the only way we're going to get sexism out of politics is by getting more women into politics. Still, I can't think of a single woman in politics who doesn't have stories to tell. Not one. For the record, it hurts to be torn apart. It may seem like it doesn't bother me to be called terrible names or have my looks mocked viciously, but it does. I'm used to it. I've grown what Eleanor Roosevelt said women in politics need, a skin as thick as a rhinoceros hide. Plus, I've always had a healthy self-esteem, thanks no doubt to my parents, who never once told me that I had to worry about being prettier or thinner. To them, I was great exactly how I was. I don't know what magic they performed to make that stick in my head all these years. I wish I did, so that parents everywhere could learn the trick. All I know is I've been far less plagued by self-doubt than a lot of women I know. And yet, it hurts to be torn apart. It didn't start with running for office. When I got glasses in the fourth grade, way smaller than the Coke bottle ones I wore later in life, I was dubbed Four Eyes. It wasn't the most original taunt, but it stung. In junior high, a few unkind schoolmates noticed the lack of ankles on my sturdy legs and did their best to embarrass me. I did talk to my mom about that one. She told me to ignore it, to rise above, to be better. That advice prepared me well for a barrage of insults later on. At college, I was spared some of the hostility many young women face because I went to Wellesley. Being at a women's college offered me the freedom to take risks, make mistakes, and even fail without making me question my fundamental worth. It also gave me opportunities to lead that I wouldn't have had at a co-ed college at that time. But once I left Wellesley, things changed. When my friend and I went to take the law school admissions test in 1968, we were among the only women in the room. We were waiting for the test to start when a group of young men started harassing us. "You don't need to be here. Why don't you go home and get married?" One said, "If you take my spot at law school, I'll get drafted and I'll go to Vietnam and I'll die." It was intense and personal. I just kept my eyes down, hoping the proctor would come to start the test, trying hard not to let them rattle me. There was a professor at Harvard Law School who looked at me, a bright and eager college senior recently offered admission, and said, "We don't need any more women at Harvard." That's part of why I went to Yale. When I started out as an attorney, I would take cases in small rural courthouses in Arkansas, and people would come to watch the lady lawyer. It was such a novelty. You could hear them commenting from the gallery on what I was wearing and how my hair looked. One time in the early 1980s, I was trying a case in Batesville, Arkansas, and in the middle of the trial, in walked six men in full camouflage. They came in and sat right behind the lawyers and just stared hard at me. As any woman who's experienced that kind of staring knows, it was truly unnerving. Afterward, the bailiff explained that it was deer season, and these hunters had come into town from their camp for supplies. When they heard that a woman was trying a case in court, they had to see it for themselves. I thought of that a few years later, when a woman doctor came to Arkansas from California to be an expert witness in a trial for my firm. She had short, spiky hair. My boss, the lead attorney on the case, told her to go buy a wig. Otherwise, he said, the jurors wouldn't be able to hear what she had to say. They'd be too focused on how she didn't look like a normal woman. I remember how taken aback she was at this request. I would have been too, not so long before, but by then I wasn't. That saddened me. I'd become used to a narrower set of expectations. Once Bill entered politics, the spotlight on me was glaring and often unkind. I've written about this before, but it's worth saying again. One of the reasons he lost the governor's race in 1980 was because I still went by my maiden name. Let that sink in for a moment, and please imagine how it felt. I was naive. I didn't think anyone would care. Maybe people would even respect what it said about our marriage, that I wanted to preserve my pre-Bill identity, that I was proud of my parents and wanted to honor them, that Bill supported my choices. When he lost, and I heard over and over that my name had played a part, I was heartsick that I might have inadvertently hurt my husband and let down his team. And I question whether there was room in public life for women like me, who might appear slightly unconventional, but still had so much to offer. So I added Clinton to Hillary Rodham. I asked my friends for hair, makeup, and clothing advice. That's never come easily to me, and until then, I didn't care. But if wearing contact lenses or changing my wardrobe would make people feel more comfortable around me, I'd try it. Later, when Bill was running for president for the first time, I stumbled again. I now had the right name, wore makeup, styled my hair, but I hadn't tamed my tongue. One of Bill's opponents in the primary attacked my job at a Little Rock law firm as a way of going after Bill. This really got under my skin. I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, I told the press in exasperation, but what I decided to do was pursue my profession. That did it. Suddenly, I was in the middle of a full-blown political firestorm with self-righteous moralists saying I had insulted American mothers. As someone who believes in supporting mothers, fathers, and families of all kinds, this hurt. And once again, I feared that my pursuit of my individual dreams, in this case, my career, which meant so much to me, would end up hurting my husband. None of these experiences made me retreat from my beliefs, but I've never really been naive again. Not much surprises me anymore. Throughout the 2016 campaign, my staff would come to me wide-eyed. "You'll never believe what Trump said today. It was vile." I always believed it, not just because of who Trump is, but because of who we can be at our worst. We've seen it too many times to be surprised. In my experience, the balancing act women in politics have to master is challenging at every level. But it gets worse the higher you rise. If we're too tough, we're unlikable. If we're too soft, we're not cut out for the big leagues. If we work too hard, we're neglecting our families. If we put family first, we're not serious about the work. If we have a career but no children, there's something wrong with us, and vice versa. If we want to compete for a higher office, we're too ambitious. Can't we just be happy with what we have? Can't we leave the higher rungs on the ladder for men? Think how often you've heard these words used about women who lead. Angry, strident, feisty, difficult, irritable, bossy, brassy, emotional, abrasive, high maintenance, ambitious, a word that I think of as neutral, even admirable, but clearly isn't for a lot of people. The linguist George Lakoff both identified this problem and embodied it when he said about Senator Elizabeth Warren, "Elizabeth has a problem. She is shrill, and there is a prejudice against shrill women. How about we stop criticizing how she speaks, which is just fine, by the way, and start paying attention to what she has to say about families and the economy?" We're also called divisive, untrustworthy, unlikable, and inauthentic. Those words ring powerfully for me. As the campaign went on, polls showed that a significant number of Americans questioned my authenticity and trustworthiness. A lot of people said they just didn't like me. I write that matter-of-factly, but believe me, it's devastating. Some of this is a direct result of my actions. I've made mistakes, been defensive about them, stubbornly resisted apologizing, but so have most men in politics. In fact, one of them just became president with a strategy of never apologize when you're wrong, just attack harder. I've been called divisive more times than I can count, and for the life of me, I can't understand why. Politics is a divisive business, it's true, and our country has gotten more polarized with every passing year. But what specifically did I do that was so unacceptable? Run for office? Lots of men do. Work on health care, one of the most contentious issues in America? Same. Cast votes as a senator? So did my 99 colleagues. When it comes to some of my most controversial actions, like my vote giving President Bush the authority to go to war in Iraq, I was far from alone. That doesn't make it right, but it also doesn't explain the venom targeted at me specifically. Why am I seen as such a divisive figure and say Joe Biden and John Kerry aren't? They've run for president. They've served at high levels of government. They've cast votes of all kinds, including some they regret, just like me. What makes me such a lightning rod for fury? I'm really asking. I'm at a loss. I know some of the distrust people feel toward me is because they've watched as I've been sucked into partisan investigations over the years. Whitewater, Travelgate, emails, each one carried out at significant taxpayer expense, each amounting to exactly nothing, but all of them leaving a mark on my reputation nearly impossible to erase. But I think there's another explanation for the skepticism I've faced in public life. I think it's partly because I'm a woman. Hear me out. Historically, women haven't been the ones writing the laws or leading the armies and navies. We're not the ones up there behind the podium, rallying crowds, uniting the country. It's men who lead. It's men who speak. It's men who represent us to the world and even to ourselves. That's been the case for so long that it has infiltrated our deepest thoughts. I suspect that for many of us, more than we might think, it feels somehow off to picture a woman president sitting in the Oval Office or the Situation Room. It's discordant to tune into a political rally and hear a woman's voice booming, screaming, screeching forth. Even the simple act of a woman standing up and speaking to a crowd is relatively new. Think about it. We know of only a handful of speeches by women before the latter half of the 20th century, and those tend to be by women in extreme and desperate situations. Joan of Arc said a lot of interesting things before they burned her at the stake. Meanwhile, when a woman lands a political punch, and not even a particularly hard one, it's not read as the normal sparring that men do all the time in politics. It makes her a nasty woman. A lot of women have had that spat in their faces, and worse, for saying not that much at all. God forbid two women have a disagreement in public, then it's a catfight. In short, it's not customary to have women lead or even to engage in the rough and tumble of politics. It's not normal. Not yet. So when it happens, it often doesn't feel quite right. That may sound vague, but it's potent. People cast their votes based on feelings like that all the time. I think this question of rightness is connected to another powerful but undefinable force in politics, authenticity. I've been asked over and over again by reporters and skeptical voters, who are you really? It's a kind of a funny question when you think about it. I'm Hillary. You've seen me in the papers and on your screens for more than 25 years. I'll bet you know more about my private life than you do about some of your closest friends. You've read my emails, for heaven's sakes. What more do you need? What could I do to be more real? Dance on a table, swear a blue streak, break down sobbing? That's not me. And if I had done any of those things, what would have happened? I'd have been ripped to pieces. Again, I wonder what it is about me that mystifies people when there are so many men in politics who are far less known, scrutinized, interviewed, photographed, and tested. Yet they're asked so much less frequently to open up, reveal themselves, prove that they're real. Some of this has to do with my composure. People say I'm guarded, and they have a point. I think before I speak. I don't just blurt out whatever comes to mind. It's a combination of my natural inclination, plus my training as a lawyer, plus decades in the public eye where every word I say is scrutinized. But why is this a bad thing? Don't we want our senators and secretaries of state, and especially our presidents, to speak thoughtfully, to respect the impact of our words? President Obama is just as controlled as I am, maybe even more so. He speaks with a great deal of care, takes his time, weighs his words. This is generally and correctly taken as evidence of his intellectual heft and rigor. He's a serious person talking about serious things. So am I. And yet, for me, it's often experienced as a negative. Even some fair-minded people who want to like me feel that there's something too controlled about how I speak. Often it's just about finding the right words. And impulsive doesn't mean the same thing as truthful. Just look at Donald Trump. Still, there's no denying that my cautiousness has had the effect of making some people feel like they weren't getting the unvarnished me. Which in turn prompted the question, what is she hiding? This frustrated me to no end, and I never figured out how to solve it. I'm not sure there was a solution. It's another variant on the impossible balancing act. If we're too composed, we're cold or fake. But if we say what we think without caution, we get slammed for it. Can you blame us for feeling like we can't win no matter what we do? Consider another emotional act, crying. I can think of many male politicians who have teared up from time to time. Some have been mocked for it. Senator Ed Muskie's political career was all but scuttled by his tears in the 1972 New Hampshire primary, even though it may have just been snow blowing in his eyes. But many men have been treated with compassion and even admiration for their displays of emotion. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bob Dole, my husband, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, they've all welled up at moments of high sentiment. That makes sense because they are humans, and sometimes humans cry. But when a woman cries, it can be viewed far less charitably. I remember what happened to Pat Schroeder, the talented and hilarious congresswoman from Colorado who considered running for president in 1987. She ultimately decided against it, and when she held a press conference to announce that, she cried for about 3 seconds. Today, when you type Pat Schroeder into Google, the very first suggestion is Pat Schroeder crying. 20 years later, she was still receiving hate mail because of it, mostly from women who felt like she let them down. I had my own famed tearful moment just before the New Hampshire primary in 2008. I didn't even cry, not really. I was talking about how tough running for office can be, because it can be very tough. And my eyes glistened for a moment, and my voice quavered for about one sentence. That was it. It became the biggest news story in America. It will, no doubt, merit a line in my obituary someday. Her eyes once watered on camera. Interestingly, many would say that my tears turned out to be a good thing for me. Dozens, if not hundreds, of pundits have commented about how that moment humanized me. Maybe that's true. If so, I'm both fine with that and a little beleaguered at the reminder that, yet again, I, a human, required humanizing at all. Still, some sought to capitalize on my perceived vulnerability in the press and on the campaign trail. When he was asked about my tears, former Democratic Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, who was still in the presidential race at the time, jumped at the chance to call me weak. I think what we need in a commander-in-chief is strength and resolve, he said. Presidential campaigns are a tough business, but being president of the United States is also a very tough business. And the president of the United States is faced with very, very difficult challenges every single day and difficult judgments every single day. What I know is that I'm prepared for that. Shortly after, he dropped out. In any case, this whole topic of being real can feel very silly. I wish we could just dismiss it and go about our business being whoever we are without worrying about whether we are satisfying some indefinable standard of realness. As the Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie writes, it's not your job to be likable. It's your job to be yourself. Yet the issues of authenticity and likability had an impact on the most consequential election of our lifetimes, and it will have an impact on future ones. So there's something extremely serious going on here, too, especially since crude, abusive, fact-free rhetoric was characterized as authentic in 2016. I've tried to adjust. After hearing repeatedly that some people didn't like my voice, I enlisted the help of a linguistic expert. He said I needed to focus on my deep breathing and try to keep something happy and peaceful in mind when I went on stage. That way, when the crowd got energized and started shouting, as crowds at rallies tend to do, I could resist doing the normal thing, which is to shout back. Men get to shout back at their heart's content, but not women. Okay, I told this expert, I'm game to try. But out of curiosity, can you give me an example of a woman in public life who has pulled this off successfully, who has met the energy of a crowd while keeping her voice soft and low? He could not. I'm not sure how to solve all this. My gender is my gender. My voice is my voice. To quote Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins, the first woman to serve in the U.S. cabinet under FDR, the accusation that I'm a woman is incontrovertible. Other women will run for president, and they will be women, and they will have women's voices. Maybe that will be less unusual by then. Maybe my campaign will have helped make it that way, and other women will have an easier time. I hope so. Near the start of my campaign, I met with my friend, Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook, who has thought about these issues a great deal. She told me that if there was one thing she wanted everyone to know from her book, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead, it's this. The data shows that for men, likability and professional success are correlated. The more successful a man is, the more people like him. With women, it's the exact opposite. The more professionally successful we are, the less people like us. Hearing it put that simply, with data behind it, felt like a light bulb turning on. Here was proof of something so many women have felt intuitively throughout our lives. Sheryl shared another insight, that women are seen favorably when they advocate for others, but unfavorably when they advocate for themselves. For example, there's virtually no downside to asking for a raise if you're a man. You'll either get it or you won't, but either way, you won't be penalized for trying. A woman who does the same is more likely to pay a price. Even if she gets a salary bump, she'll lose a measure of goodwill. The exception is when a woman asks for a raise on someone else's behalf. Then she's seen as generous and a team player. This, too, resonated with me. People like me when I'm in a supporting role, campaigning for my husband, serving as a member of President Obama's cabinet. It's okay for me to be a fierce advocate in those capacities, but when I stand up and say, now I'd like a chance to lead, everything changes. You have a steep mountain to climb, Sheryl warned that day. They will have no empathy for you. It's not easy for any woman in politics, but I think it's safe to say that I got a whole other level of vitriol flung my way. Crowds at Trump rallies called for my imprisonment more times than I can count. They shouted, guilty, guilty, like the religious zealots in Game of Thrones, chanting shame, shame, while Cersei Lannister walked back to the Red Keep. As Susan Bordeaux, a Pulitzer Prize-nominated gender studies professor, put it in her book, The Destruction of Hillary Clinton, it was almost medieval. Mary Beard, the classics professor at the University of Cambridge, observed that this venom harkened back to an even earlier time. One popular image among Trump supporters, found on everything from T-shirts to coffee mugs, depicted Trump holding up my severed head, like Perseus from ancient Greek mythology, lifting high the head of Medusa. What in the world was this? I've been in politics for a long time, but I was taken aback by the flood of hatred that seemed only to grow as we got closer to Election Day. I had left the State Department, one of the most admired public servants in America. Now people seem to think I was evil. Not just not my cup of tea, but evil. It was flabbergasting and frightening. Was this all because I'm a woman? No, but I believe it was motivation for some of those chanters and some of that bile. Later, I read an interview with Margaret Atwood, the prescient author of The Handmaid's Tale, which put the campaign into yet another historical light. You can find websites that say Hillary was actually a Satanist with demonic powers, she said. It's so 17th century that you can hardly believe it. The Puritan witch hunts may be long over, but something fanatical about unruly women still lurks in our national subconscious. That doesn't just affect me and other candidates. It affects our supporters. Nearly 4 million people joined a Facebook group supporting my campaign, fittingly called Pantsuit Nation. It was a secret group. It had to be. Otherwise, its members were exposing themselves to vicious, sexist online harassment from both the right and the left. You can hardly open a newspaper these days without reading another grim story. Female engineers reporting blatant harassment in Silicon Valley. Women entrepreneurs making pitches to investment firms and being propositioned in response. A new study finding that women are given a harder time than men in job interviews. Another finding that women are penalized when they decline to reveal their salary history, while men end up making more when they do the same. That's why it's so maddening that the basic fact that sexism is alive and well should still be up for debate. I can't count the number of times that good-hearted men who should know better dismiss the notion that sexism and outright misogyny are still potent forces in our national life. But things have changed, they say, as Donald Trump brags about groping women, and a few weeks later wins the presidency. As his rally-goers chant, "Trump that bitch," as the White House proudly releases photos of old white men gleefully deciding which health services to take away from women. And on that fundamental question of whether it would be good to see a woman, any woman, not just me, become president, the electorate is deeply, depressingly divided. A 2014 Pew Research Center poll found that 69% of Democratic women and 46% of Democratic men, not terrible, but you can do better than that, Democratic men, said they hoped to see a female president in their lifetime. But only 20% of Republican women and only 16% of Republican men did. In 2008, researchers found that more than a quarter of the population expressed anger or upset feelings at the mere thought of a female president. And after the 2016 election, the Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society at the University of Arkansas put out a report on the impact of sexism on the race. Researchers asked people to respond to 5 statements that reflect sexist thinking, including feminists are seeking for women to have more power than men, and discrimination against women is no longer a problem in the United States. In results that surprised no one, more than a third of respondents gave answers that were sexist. Trump voters were more sexist than Clinton voters. Republicans were far more sexist than Democrats. And not just men, women were quite sexist too. On that note, beginning even before I ran, political commentators wondered whether I'd inspire an unbeatable wave of women to come out and vote for me in the same way President Obama inspired record-breaking black turnout. I hoped I would, of course, but I had my doubts. Gender hasn't proven to be the motivating force for women voters that some hope it might be. if it were, we'd probably have had a woman president or two by now, don't you think? In the end, I won an overwhelming majority of the votes of black women, 94%, and Latino women, 68%. And I won women overall by a safe margin, 54%. But I failed to win a majority of white women, although I did better with them than Obama did in 2012. Yes, things have changed. Some things are a lot better. But many are still bad. And they are connected. The bad is the backlash to the good. Women's advancement has set into motion vast changes that inspire intense feelings of all kinds. Some of us are exhilarated. Others feel a whole lot of rage. The good news, and there is good news, is that there's another side to all of this. It can also be deeply rewarding to be a woman in politics. You know that just by being in the room, you're making government more representative of the people. You're bringing a vital perspective that would otherwise go unheard. That always made me stand up a little straighter. It's why I love the song, "The Room Where It Happens," from Lin-Manuel Miranda's brilliant musical, Hamilton. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens. It felt really good to be in a room where things happen, the Oval Office, the Senate chamber, as an advocate for issues that mattered to me, education, equal pay, health care, women's rights. Maybe those issues would have been close to my heart, even if I were a man, but maybe not. Life naturally pushed me in their direction. A young mom interested in policy often ends up working on kids' issues. A first lady is often involved with women's issues. That was okay with me. Some might have found it limiting, but I consider these real-life issues that affect us all. Later, I moved into different realms, working to rebuild New York after 9/11 as a hometown senator, supporting our troops and caring for our wounded warriors and all our vets as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, keeping our country and world safe as U.S. Secretary of State. I moved into different rooms, the Situation Room, foreign ministries, the United Nations, and I found that the decades of work I had done on women and families served me well in all those places, because it meant that I understood the intricacies of people's lives. I knew how governments could help or hurt families. I knew how to marshal resources and support to the people who needed it the most. It turned out that my work on so-called women's and children's issues prepared me well for nearly everything else I've ever done. I also believe the fact that I'm a woman is one reason why so many people open up to me about the details of their lives and families. They tell me about their children's medical diagnoses, their caregiving of aging parents, troubles in their marriages and families' finances, painful experiences with sexual harassment and discrimination. Warm-hearted male politicians also receive these confessionals, but from what I can see, women hear them more often. Maybe it's easier to cry in front of us. Maybe it feels like talking to a girlfriend. All I know is that a lot of people have grabbed my hand and told me their worries and dreams, and that's been a unique privilege. There's another thing that women confide in me about, and that's stories of their reproductive health. No essay about women in politics could be complete without talking about this. It is such a central part of women's lives, whether we become mothers and at what age and under what circumstances. Reproductive health in all its complexity, pregnancy, fertility, birth control, miscarriage, abortion, labor, birth, can comprise some of the most joyful and terrifying moments we will ever experience. But a lot of the time, we process these moments in silence. These stories go unspoken, even among women. Then I meet women at rallies or dinners or fundraisers or just taking a walk, and they take a deep breath and let it all out. At this moment in America, more than 44 years since Roe v. Wade, women's access to birth control and abortion is still under constant threat. I saw the effect of this in the 2016 election. Reproductive health was rarely mentioned in any of the primary debates, and when it was mentioned, it was often because I brought it up. I was dismayed when Bernie Sanders dismissed Planned Parenthood as just another part of the establishment when they endorsed me over him. Few organizations are as intimately connected to the day-to-day lives of Americans from all classes and backgrounds as Planned Parenthood, and few are under more persistent attack. I'm not sure what's establishment about that, and I don't know why someone running to be the Democratic nominee for president would say so. After the election, Bernie suggested that Democrats should be open to nominating and supporting candidates who are anti-choice. Other topics, such as economic justice, are sacrosanct, but apparently women's health is not. I don't mean to criticize only Bernie here. A lot of progressives join him in thinking that reproductive rights are negotiable. And to be clear, I believe there's room in our party for a wide range of personal views on abortion. I've been working for a quarter century with Democrats and Republicans alike to reduce the number of abortions, in part by expanding access to birth control and family planning, and we've made progress. And I picked as my running mate Tim Kaine, a Democrat personally opposed to abortion because of his Catholic faith, but supportive of women's rights as a matter of law and policy. But when personal views on abortion become public actions, votes on legislation or judges or funding that erode women's rights, that's a different matter. We have to remain a big tent, but a big tent is only as strong as the poles that hold it up. Reproductive rights are central to women's rights and women's health, and it's one of the most important tent poles we've got. And remember, it's a constitutional right as defined in Roe v. Wade. There's overwhelming evidence about what happens when these rights are denied. Texas has defunded Planned Parenthood and refused to expand Medicaid, and maternal mortality doubled between 2010 and 2014. That's the worst in the nation, and it's higher than the rate in many developing countries. 600 women have died in Texas, not from abortions, but from trying to give birth. The number of Texas teenagers having abortions actually increased when support for family planning was cut. In one county, Gregg, it went up 191% between 2012 and 2014. Ultimately, I'm pro-choice, pro-family, and pro-faith, because I believe that our ability to decide whether and when to become mothers is intrinsic to our liberty. When government gets involved in this intimate realm, whether in places like China, which forced women to have abortions, or in communist Romania, which forced women to bear children, it is horrific. I've visited hospitals in countries where poor women have no access to safe and legal abortion. I've seen what happens when desperate women take matters into their own hands. As I see it, this issue comes down to the question, who decides? We can debate the morality of abortion forever, and I have spent many hours engaged in such debates and surely will spend many more. But at the end of the day, who decides whether a woman gets or stays pregnant? A congressman who has never met her? A judge who has spoken with her for maybe a few minutes? Or should the woman be able to make this momentous decision about her life, her body, her future, for herself? Someone's got to decide. I say, let women decide. I'm not sure what we call our current era of feminism. I've lost count of which wave we're in. But there's a lot that feels new. There are all these new words, mansplaining. The second I heard it, I thought, yes, we needed a word for that. Intersectionality, an academic term for that vital idea that feminism must engage race and class. Revenge porn, trolls, modern twists on ancient harms. While we're defining things, let's take a moment for feminism. The advocacy of women's rights on the basis of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes. Not domination, not oppression, equality. Or as the English writer and philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft put it 225 years ago, I do not wish women to have power over men, but over themselves. Then there's emotional labor. Now that's a good one. It describes all the unpaid, uncounted, often unseen work that people, overwhelmingly women, perform to keep their families and workplaces humming along. Organizing office birthday parties, arranging the kids' summer camp, coordinating visits with in-laws, helping the new employee feel welcome and included. The list is endless. All the little details without which life would devolve into chaos and misery. Not all women take on these tasks, and that's fine. And some men do, and I salute them. But it's largely women's work. Finally, someone thought to name it. In my marriage, I've definitely been the one to perform the bulk of the emotional labor. I'm the one who schedules family visits, vacations, and dinners with friends. Bill has many positive qualities, but managing the logistical details of a household is not one of them. Of course, our situation is unique. For years, he was a governor, then the president. He wasn't going to be the parent keeping track of the SAT registration deadline, although he always knew exactly what Chelsea was studying at school. We've also been privileged, since moving into the governor's mansion years ago, to have people helping ensure that we're well-fed and taken care of. Neither of us has had to make an emergency run to the store to pick up milk in decades. Still, even our privileged lives require a lot of small but vital actions and decisions to keep rolling along, and I'm the one who tends to handle them. That labor extends to my friendships. In March 2017, a few of my close girlfriends came to New York for the weekend. A new friend joined us and asked, "How do you all know each other?" That led to my friends going around the table explaining in great detail how I have lovingly interfered in their lives over the years. When I got sick, Hillary hounded me until I went to her doctor and called me immediately after for a full report. That's nothing. When my little girl cut her face, Hillary insisted I get a plastic surgeon and then called back 10 minutes later with the best one in Washington on the phone. They knew me well. It happens at work, too. I make sure everyone has eaten, that my staff is wearing sunscreen if we're at an event in the baking sun. When reporters who traveled abroad with us got sick or injured, I made sure they had ginger ale and crackers and would send the State Department doctor to their room with Cipro and anti-nausea drugs. None of this is unusual. I've seen women CEOs serve coffee at meetings. Women heads of state walk tissues over to a sneezing staffer. It's also not new. It was women like Dr. Dorothy Height who did a lot of the unglamorous work of the civil rights movement, recruiting volunteers and organizing workshops and coordinating sit-ins and freedom rides. It is women who do a lot of the daily knitting in Congress, identifying problems, bringing together stakeholders, building effective coalitions. It's often women who handle constituent outreach, answering phones and responding to letters and emails. And in my experience, a lot of women make those calls and write those letters to Congress. We're not just the designated worriers in our families, we're also the designated worriers for our country. I think all this may help explain why women leaders around the world tend to rise higher in parliamentary systems rather than presidential ones like ours. Prime ministers are chosen by their colleagues, people they've worked with day in and day out who've seen firsthand their talents and competence. It's a system designed to reward women's skill at building relationships, which requires emotional labor. Presidential systems aren't like that. They reward different talents, speaking to large crowds, looking commanding on camera, dominating in debates, galvanizing mass movements, and in America, raising $1 billion. You've got to give it to Trump. He's hateful, but it's hard to look away from him. He uses his size to project power. He looms over the podium, gets in interviewers' faces, glowers, threatens to punch people. I watched a video of one of our debates with the sound off, and discovered that between his theatrical arm waving and face making and his sheer size and aggressiveness, I watched him a lot more than I watched me. I'm guessing a lot of voters did the same thing. I also suspect that if a woman was as aggressive or melodramatic as he is, she'd be laughed or booed off the stage. In the end, even though I was judged to have won all three of our debates, his supporters awarded him points for his hypermasculine, aggressive behavior. As for me, when it comes to politics, my style can be viewed as female. I've always focused on listening over speaking. I like town hall meetings because I get to hear from people and ask follow-up questions to my heart's content. I prefer one-on-one small group conversations to big speeches and finding common ground over battling it out. When I was a senator, I spent a lot of time getting to know my colleagues, including gruff Republicans who wanted nothing to do with me at first. In 2000, Trent Lott, the Republican leader, wistfully wondered if lightning would strike and I wouldn't take the oath of office. By 2016, he was telling people I was a very capable lady who did a good job, and he told my husband that I had done more to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina than anyone outside the Gulf Coast. A number of other conservative Republicans also came to like me when I was their colleague in the Senate, helping them pass bills, refilling their coffee cups in the Senate dining room, or sitting beside them in the Senate's private prayer meeting. One ultra-conservative senator came to see me to apologize for having hated me and saying terrible things about me over the years. He asked, "Mrs. Clinton, will you forgive me?" I know that might sound incredible now, but it's true. I told him that, of course, I would. Dramatic spiritual conversions aside, emotional labor isn't particularly thrilling as far as the political media or some of the electorate is concerned. I've been dinged for being too interested in the details of policy. Boring. Too practical. Not inspiring. Too willing to compromise. Sell out. Too focused on smaller, achievable steps rather than sweeping changes that have little to no chance of ever coming true. Establishment candidate. But just as a household falls apart without emotional labor, so does politics grind to a halt if no one is actually listening to one another or reading the briefings or making plans that have a chance of working. I guess that might be considered boring. I don't find it boring, but you might. But here's the thing. Someone has to do it. In my experience, a lot of the time, it's women. A lot of the time, it's dismissed as not that important. And I don't think that's a coincidence. This is not okay, I thought. It was the second presidential debate, and Donald Trump was looming behind me. 2 days before, the world heard him brag about groping women. Now we were on a small stage, and no matter where I walked, he followed me closely, staring at me, making faces. It was incredibly uncomfortable. He was literally breathing down my neck. My skin crawled. It was one of those moments where you wish you could hit pause and ask everyone watching, "Well, what would you do? Do you stay calm, keep smiling, and carry on as if he weren't repeatedly invading your space? Or do you turn, look him in the eye, and say loudly and clearly, 'Back up, you creep. Get away from me. I know you love to intimidate women, but you can't intimidate me, so back up.'" I chose option A. I kept my cool, aided by a lifetime of dealing with difficult men trying to throw me off. I did, however, grip the microphone extra hard. I wonder, though, whether I should have chosen option B. It certainly would have been better TV. Maybe I have overlearned the lesson of staying calm, biting my tongue, digging my fingernails into a clenched fist, smiling all the while, determined to present a composed face to the world. Of course, had I told Trump off, he surely would have capitalized on it gleefully. A lot of people recoil from an angry woman or even just a direct one. Look at what happened to Elizabeth Warren, silenced in the Senate chamber for reading a letter from Coretta Scott King because it was critical of Jeff Sessions, a male senator, during his confirmation hearing for attorney general. Moments later, Jeff Merkley, a male senator, was allowed to read the letter. Funny how that worked. Senator Kamala Harris was derided as hysterical for her entirely cool-headed and professional questioning of Jeff Sessions, him again, during a Senate hearing. As one writer put it, she was being Hillary'd. Arianna Huffington was recently interrupted in a meeting of the Uber board of directors when she was making a point about, of all things, how important it was to increase the number of women on the board. And the man who talked over her did so to say that increasing women would only mean more talking. You can't make this up. In other words, this isn't something that only happens to me, not even close. It also doesn't just happen to women on the Democratic side of politics. Trump made fun of Carly Fiorina's face because she competed against him for president. He lashed out at Megyn Kelly and Mika Brzezinski in gross, physical terms because they challenged him. Maybe that's why Nicole Wallace, White House Communications Director for George W. Bush, has warned that the Republican Party is in danger of being permanently associated with misogyny if leaders don't stand up to Trump's treatment of women. This harkens back to a powerful ad we ran during the campaign called Mirrors. It shows adolescent girls looking tentatively at themselves in the mirror, tucking their hair behind their ears, evaluating their profile, trying to decide if they are okay looking, like so many girls do when they see themselves. Over their images, we ran a tape of cruel things Trump has said on the record about women over the years. She's a slob. She ate like a pig. I'd look her right in that fat, ugly face of hers. Was this the voice we wanted in our daughters' heads, our granddaughters, our nieces, or our sons or grandsons or nephews' heads, for that matter? They deserve better than the toxic masculinity Trump embodies. Well, he's in their heads now. His voice resounds far and wide. Now it's on all of us to make sure his ugly words don't damage our girls and boys forever. 2 days before the debate, my team and I had finished a grueling morning debate prep session. We had taken a break for lunch. The television was on in the room with no volume. Then a commentator came on to warn viewers that they were about to hear something vulgar. Boy, was that true. I don't have a lot to say about the Access Hollywood tape that hasn't been said. I will just note that Donald Trump is gleefully describing committing sexual assault. That got somewhat lost in the shock of it all. Too many people focused on his boorishness. Such a crude man, so vulgar. True. But even if he were the height of elegance and graciousness, it wouldn't make it okay that he's describing sexual assault. For many, hearing the Donald Trump tape was literally sickening. As for me, it made me sad. For women and girls, for men and boys, for all of us. It was horrible. Just horrible. It still is. And it always will be. Because that tape is never going away. It's part of our history now. To divert attention from his own ugliness, Trump brought to our second debate three women who had accused my husband of bad acts decades ago, plus a woman whose accused rapist I had been ordered by a judge to represent back in Arkansas. It was an awful stunt. I don't know what the Trump campaign was hoping to accomplish other than the obvious, dredge up old allegations that had been litigated years before, divert attention from the Access Hollywood tape, throw me off my game, and distract voters from the election's unbelievably high stakes. He wasn't trying to make a stand for these women. He was just using them. This was a presidential debate, That's a big deal. We were supposed to talk about issues that mattered to people's lives. Instead, Trump used this moment to get back in his comfort zone. He loves to humiliate women, loves to talk about how disgusting we are. He was hoping to rattle me. I was determined not to give him that satisfaction. Before I stepped on stage, Ron Klain said to me, "He's trying to get in your head." I said, "You think?" Then I went out there and won the debate. Something I wish every man across America understood is how much fear accompanies women throughout our lives. So many of us have been threatened or harmed. So many of us have helped friends recover from a traumatic incident. It's difficult to convey what all this violence does to us. It adds up in our hearts and our nervous systems. A few years ago, the hashtag #YesAllWomen was trending for a while. It spoke to me like it did to so many others. In college and law school, we had a million defensive habits. Hold your keys like a weapon when you're out alone at night. Walk one another home no matter what. Many women I know have been groped, grabbed, or worse. It even happens to members of Congress. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has written frankly about how congressmen have leered at her and grabbed her waist in the congressional gym. I'm very lucky that nothing too bad ever happened to me. One time in college, I went on a blind date with a young man who wouldn't take repeated no's for an answer, and I had to slap him to get him away from me. But he did back off, and I went to bed that night, shaken but not traumatized. And when I was 29, working for Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign in Indiana, I had dinner one night with a group of older men who were in charge of the Democratic Party's Get Out the Vote operation in the state. I had been pestering them for a while for information about their Election Day plans, and they were annoyed with me. I started explaining once again what I needed to know from them and why. Suddenly, one of the men reached across the table, grabbed me by my turtleneck, and yanked me toward him. He hissed in my face, "Just shut up." I froze, then managed to pull his hand from my neck, tell him to never touch me again, and walk out of the room on shaking legs. The whole incident probably lasted 30 seconds. I'll never forget it. Yet that's nothing compared to the violence that millions of women and girls across our country endure on a regular basis. About 4 months before Donald Trump's Access Hollywood tape was released, a very different message went viral. An unnamed woman known as Emily Doe, who had been sexually assaulted while unconscious, wrote a letter about her ordeal and read it in court to her attacker, a Stanford athlete. A friend forwarded the letter to me. I read it once and immediately went back to the beginning and read it again. I hope I can meet the author someday and tell her how brave I think she is. To girls everywhere, she wrote, "I am with you. On nights when you feel alone, I am with you. When people doubt you or dismiss you, I am with you. I fought every day for you, so never stop fighting. I believe you." As the author Anne Lamott once wrote, "Lighthouses don't go running all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there shining." Although I can't save every boat, I hope that by speaking today you absorbed a small amount of light, a small knowing that you can't be silenced, a small satisfaction that justice was served, a small assurance that we are getting somewhere, and a big, big knowing that you are important, unquestionably. You are untouchable. You are beautiful. You are to be valued, respected, undeniably. Every minute of every day, you are powerful, and nobody can take that away from you. Early on the morning of November 9th, when it came time to decide on what I'd say in my concession speech, I remembered those words. Inspired by them, I wrote these. "To all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams." Wherever she is, I hope Emily Doe knows how much her words and her strength meant to so many. There's yet another side to the matter of women in politics. It's not just that politics can be rewarding for those women who choose to enter it. In the long run, it also makes our politics better for everyone. I believe this as strongly as I believe anything. We need our politics to resemble our people. When the people who run our cities, states, and country overwhelmingly look a certain way, say white and male, and overwhelmingly have a shared background, wealthy, privileged, we end up with laws and policies that don't come close to addressing the realities of Americans' lives. And since that's a basic requirement of government, it's a pretty big thing to get wrong. In other words, representation matters. Is representation everything? Of course not. Just because I'm a woman, it doesn't mean I'd be a good president for women. I would have been, but not only because of my gender. But it does matter, and often in concrete ways. I remember when I was pregnant with Chelsea, working at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, and repeatedly went to my superiors to ask about their maternity leave policy. They avoided the question until there was no longer any way to avoid it, then stammered that they didn't have a policy. No woman who's worked here has ever come back after having a baby. So I wrote my own. I was a new partner and had the power to do that. But what about more junior lawyers or support staff? Would they have been expected to come in a few days after giving birth or not come back to work at all? It took a woman in the room to notice a huge hole in the firm's policies and care enough to fix it. Representation matters in less visible but no less valuable ways, too. I remember being riveted as a little girl whenever a woman appeared in our history lessons. Abigail Adams, Sojourner Truth, Ida Tarbell, Amelia Earhart. Even if it just amounted to a sentence in a dusty book, and often that's all they got, it thrilled me. The great men in our history books thrilled me too, but it meant something different, something quietly momentous to learn that a woman had done something important. It opened the world up a little more. It made me dream a little bigger. I remember coming home from school and opening Life magazine to read about Margaret Chase Smith, the gutsy Republican senator from Maine who stood up to Joe McCarthy. Years later, when I became First Lady, I wrote her a fan letter. As a young woman, I was moved and inspired, watching Barbara Jordan speak out eloquently for the rule of law on the House Judiciary Committee during the Watergate hearings, Geraldine Ferraro stand on stage as the vice presidential candidate for my party, Barbara Mikulski shake up the U.S. Senate, Dianne Feinstein take on the NRA, and Shirley Chisholm run for president. What hadn't felt possible suddenly was. When Chelsea was a little girl, I saw the power of representation through a new lens. I watched her leaf through the pages of her children's books, searching intently for the girl characters. Now little girls have a new group of fictional heroines to look up to, including Wonder Woman and General Leia. She got a promotion from Princess. Slowly but surely, Hollywood is moving in the right direction. That's why it meant so much to me to see all the little girls and young women at my campaign rallies and all the moms and dads pointing and saying, "Look, you see? She's running for president. You're smart like she is. You're tough like she is. You can be president. You can be anything you want to be." After the election, I received a letter from a medical student named Kristen in Dearborn, Michigan. She wrote, "I saw you speak for the first time as a small girl. My mom took me and helped me to stand on a fence and held me by the back of my overalls because I kept trying to wave to you and cheer you on. I was so ecstatic to hear such a smart woman speak, and I've never looked back. You never let that version of me down. I read your history as I got older, and then I got to see more speeches and read your writings. You never let down the older versions of me either." To this day, even knowing how things turned out, the memories of all those proud and excited girls, and the thought of the women they will become means more to me than I can express. I know that there are some hearing this who will sneer. Representation, it's so soft, so wimpy, so liberal. Well, if you can't imagine why it would matter for many of us to see a woman elected president, and that it wouldn't matter only to women, just like the election of Barack Obama made people of all races, not just African Americans, feel proud and inspired, I'd simply urge you to accept that it matters to many of your fellow Americans, even if it doesn't to you. I wish so badly that I had been able to take the oath of office and achieve that milestone for women. Still, there were many feminist moments in this election we shouldn't forget. I will always remember Bill's speech at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. At one point, he uttered the memorable words, "On February 27, 1980, 15 minutes after I got home from the National Governors Association Conference in Washington, Hillary's water broke." Watching from our home in New York, I had to laugh. That was the first time that had ever been said about a presidential nominee. I thought it was about time. There's another moment I want to note that a lot of people missed when it happened, but which I will never forget. A few days before election night 2016, Beyoncé and Jay-Z performed at a rally for me in Cleveland. Beyoncé took the microphone. Quote, "I want my daughter to grow up seeing a woman lead our country and know that her possibilities are limitless," she said. "We have to think about the future of our daughters, our sons, and vote for someone who cares for them as much as we do, and that is why I'm with her," unquote. And then that infamous 1992 quote appeared in giant block letters on a huge screen behind her. "I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was pursue my profession." Something that had been so controversial was being reclaimed as a message of independence and strength, just like I had meant it to be all those years ago, right before my eyes. Thanks, Beyoncé. Will we ever have a woman president? We will. I hope I'll be around to vote for her, assuming I agree with her agenda. She'll have to earn my vote based on her qualifications and ideas, just like anyone else. When that day comes, I believe that my two presidential campaigns will have helped pave the way for her. We did not win, but we made the sight of a woman nominee more familiar. We brought the possibility of a woman president closer. We helped bring into the mainstream the idea of a woman leader for our country. That's a big deal, and everyone who played a role in making that happen should feel deeply proud. This was worth it. I will never think otherwise. This fight was worth it. That's why I'm heartened that a wave of women across America have expressed more willingness to run for office after this election, not less. I'll admit, I was worried that it would go the other way. And I will always do my part to encourage more women to run and to send the message to little girls, teenagers, and young women that their dreams and ambitions are worth chasing. Over the years, I've hired and promoted a lot of young women and young men. Much of the time, this is how it went. Me: I'd like you to take on a bigger role. Young man: I'm thrilled. I'll do a great job. I won't let you down. Young woman: Are you sure I'm ready? I'm not sure. Maybe in a year? These reactions aren't innate. Men aren't naturally more confident than women. We tell them to believe in themselves, and we tell women to doubt themselves. We tell them this in a million ways, starting when they're young. We've got to do better, every single one of us. What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open. Muriel Rukeyser. motherhood, wifehood, daughterhood, sisterhood. I don't know what it's like for other women, but growing up, I didn't think that much about my gender, except when it was front and center. Like in eighth grade, when I wrote to NASA to say that I dreamt of becoming an astronaut, and someone there wrote back, "Sorry, little girl, we don't accept women into the space program." Or when the boy who beat me in a student government race in high school told me I was really stupid if I thought a girl could be elected president of the school. Or when I heard from Wellesley College, I was in. On these occasions, I felt my gender powerfully. But most of the time, I was just a kid, a student, a reader, a fan, a friend. The fact that I was female was secondary. Sometimes it practically slipped my mind. Other women may have had different experiences, but that's how it was for me. My parents made that possible. They treated my brothers, Hugh and Tony, and me like three individual kids with three individual personalities instead of putting me in a box marked female and them in a box marked male. They never admonished me for not acting like a girl when I played baseball with the boys. They stressed the importance of education because they didn't want their daughter to feel constrained by tired ideas of what women should do with our lives. They wanted more for me than that. Later in life, I started to see myself differently when I took on roles that felt deeply and powerfully womanly. Wife, daughter to aging parents, girlfriend, and most of all, mother and grandmother. These identities transformed me, yet somehow also felt like the truest expressions of myself. They felt both like pulling on a new garment and shedding my skin. I don't talk a lot about these pieces of my life. They feel private. They are private. But they're also universal experiences, and I believe in the value of women sharing our stories with one another. It's how we support each other through our private struggles and how we find the strength to build the best possible lives for ourselves. These roles haven't been easy or painless. Sometimes they've been very painful indeed, but they have been worth it. My goodness, have they been worth it. Years rolled on again, and Wendy had a daughter. This ought not to be written in ink, but in a golden splash. J.M. Barrie. On the final night of the Democratic National Convention in July, my daughter introduced me to the nation. I was backstage, ready to walk on stage the instant she was done. At least I was supposed to be ready. But I couldn't pull myself away from the television where her face filled the screen. Hearing her talk, I was grateful for waterproof mascara. The fact that my poised, beautiful daughter was also standing up there as Charlotte's and Aiden's mother, she had given birth to her son only 5 weeks earlier, made this even more special. During a burst of applause near the end of her remarks, Jim Margolis, who was keeping his eye on the clock, yelled to me, "We've got to go!" But Chelsea wasn't done, and I didn't want to miss any of it. Finally, Jim yelled, "Now we've really got to go." I snapped to attention, and we raced down the hall and up the stairs in the dark. I stepped out on stage in the nick of time. From the moment she was born, Chelsea has captivated me. I suspect a lot of parents know what I mean. My child has me hooked. That night was no different. She looked so happy recounting stories of growing up. It's always interesting to me to hear her perspective of her childhood. You try so many things as a parent. I remember how hours after she was born, Bill walked around the hospital room with tiny Chelsea in his arms, explaining everything to her. We didn't want to waste a moment. Here's what Chelsea talked about at the DNC. Our weekly trips to the library and church. Lazy afternoons outside lying on the grass and spotting shapes in the clouds. Playing a game of her invention. Which dinosaur is the friendliest? She says I warned her not to be fooled that even seemingly friendly dinosaurs were still dinosaurs. That sounds like me, wasting no opportunity to impart some practical advice, even in absurd circumstances. She talked about her favorite books that we read to her, and those she later read by herself and told us all about, like the science fantasy A Wrinkle in Time. Mostly Chelsea talked about me always being there and how she always knew how much we loved and valued her. I cannot express the happiness it brings to hear my daughter say that. This was my number one priority every day of her childhood, making sure she knew that nothing was more important than her. I worried about this because Bill and I were extremely busy people. We worked long hours, we traveled frequently, and the phone in our house rang constantly, often with urgent news. It wouldn't be unexpected for a little girl growing up surrounded by all that to feel overlooked. Over the years, I've met politicians' kids who say, "I was pretty lonely. I had to compete with the whole world for my parents' attention." That was the worry that kept me up at night when Chelsea was young. I couldn't bear the thought. One way we handled that was by not excluding her from our work. We talked about issues and politics with her starting from a young age. In her speech at the Democratic National Convention, she described how hard it was to see me lose the fight for health care reform in 1994 when she was 14. She was there to comfort me and help provide diversions, watching Pride and Prejudice together. For me, becoming a mother was the fulfillment of a long-held dream. I love children, love just sitting with them and being silly, love bringing smiles to their sweet faces. If you're ever looking for me at a party, you're likely to find me wherever the kids are. Before I even met my husband and thought about starting a family, I was a lawyer and advocate for children. When Bill and I learned that we were going to be parents, we were ecstatic. We jumped around our kitchen like we were kids ourselves. Getting pregnant was not easy for me, but pregnancy itself was blessedly uneventful. Chelsea arrived 3 weeks early. I was gigantic and more than ready to meet my little one. Neither Bill nor I cared a bit whether the baby was a boy or girl. But when the doctor said, "It's a girl," I felt so happy. It was like a sunburst beaming out of my chest. A girl. I hadn't realized how much I wanted a daughter until she arrived. She was a wish so secret I didn't even know that I had wished it. Then she was here, and I knew she was what I always wanted. If we'd had a son, I'm sure I would have been just as over the moon. I would have realized at once that I had always wanted a son, a sweet little boy to raise into a strong and caring man. But that's not what happened. We had a daughter. And not just any daughter, but someone who brought such joy and love into our lives. It felt like fate. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me by a mile. There's just something about daughters. From the very beginning, I felt a rush of wisdom that I wanted to impart to her about womanhood. How to be brave, how to build real confidence, and fake it when you have to. How to respect yourself without taking yourself too seriously. How to love yourself, or at least try to and never stop trying. How to love others generously and courageously. How to be strong but gentle. How to decide whose opinion to value and whose to disregard quietly. How to believe in yourself even when others don't. Some of these lessons were hard won for me. I wanted badly to save my daughter the trouble. Maybe Chelsea could skip all that and arrive more quickly at a place of self-assurance. My desire to be the best mother in the world didn't translate into knowledge about how to do it. At first, I was pretty inept. In those early days, she wouldn't stop crying. I was nearly frantic. Finally, I sat down and tried my best to make eye contact with this squirming infant. "Chelsea," I said firmly, "this is new for both of us. I've never been a mother before. You've never been a baby. We're just going to have to help each other do the best we can." Those weren't magic words that stopped her wailing, but they helped, if for no other reason than that they reminded me I was completely new at this and should be gentle with myself. Over the years, I've met so many frazzled new mothers who can't figure out how to soothe their babies or get them to nurse or sleep. And I see in their eyes that same discombobulation I felt in those early days of Chelsea's life. It reminds me all over again how having a newborn is like every switch in your body being flicked on simultaneously. Your brain becomes a one-track mind. Is the baby okay? Is the baby hungry? Is the baby sleeping? Is the baby breathing? Playing on an endless loop. If you're a new mother reading this, sleep-deprived and semi-coherent, maybe wearing a tattered sweatshirt and dreaming of your next shower, please know that so many of us have been right where you are. You're doing great. It'll get easier, so just hang in there. And maybe ask your partner or mom or friend to take over for a few hours so you can have that shower and get some sleep. Chelsea was born in 1980, a time when opportunities for women were greater than ever before in human history. She wouldn't face some of the closed doors I had. Bill and I were determined that our daughter was never going to hear, "Girls can't do that," not if we could help it. What I couldn't know back then, holding this tiny baby in my arms, is how much she would teach me about courage, confidence, and grace. Chelsea has an inner strength that amazes me. She is smart, thoughtful, observant, and even under stress or attack, conducts herself with poise and self-possession. She is gifted at friendship, always eager to meet new people, but also comfortable with solitude. She trusts her mind and feeds it constantly. She stands up for what she believes. She is one of the toughest people I know, but her toughness is quiet and deliberate, easy to underestimate. That makes her even more formidable. Her smile is full of real joy. Bill and I had a hand in all of this, I'm sure, but Chelsea has been Chelsea from the very start. I think most parents find that their children are more formed when they arrive than we expect. It's like Khalil Gibran wrote in The Prophet, "Your children are not your children. They come through you, but not from you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday." Like all moms, I wanted to protect Chelsea from illness and injury, bullies, disappointments, and a dangerous world. I also had a different set of threats in mind, which are particular to the daughters of public figures. She grew up on the front page of newspapers. She was attacked by right-wing personalities on the radio and mocked on television when she was just 13 years old. It still makes my blood boil. There were plenty of nights when I wondered if we had made a terrible mistake by subjecting her to this life. I worried not just that she'd feel self-conscious, but also that she'd become too practiced in the art of putting on a happy face for the cameras. I wanted her to have a rich interior life, to be sincere and spontaneous, to own her feelings, not stifle them. In short, I wanted her to be a real person with her own identity and interests. The only way I knew how to do that was to make her life as normal as possible. Chelsea had chores at the White House. If she wanted a new book or game, she had to save her allowance to buy it. When she was bratty, to her credit, an extremely rare occurrence, she was chastised and sometimes punished. Our go-to was no TV or phone privileges for a week. But there's a limit to how much you can make life normal for the president's daughter. So we also decided to embrace and celebrate the incredible opportunities that her unusual childhood and adolescence offered. She went on visits overseas with us, touring the Forbidden City in China, riding an elephant in Nepal, having conversations with Nelson Mandela. She even found herself at 14 discussing 100 years of solitude with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Since she had always been interested in science and health, Bill made a point of introducing her to just about every scientist and doctor who visited the White House. She relished these conversations and experiences. "This is so cool," she said the first time we saw Camp David, on her first flight on Air Force One, when she came along as I led the U.S. delegation to the 1994 Winter Olympics in Norway. I watched her, the questions she asked, her excited reflections on everything we saw and experienced, and was delighted. She never grew bored or acted entitled. She knew how special it all was. Perhaps most important to me, Chelsea never needed to be reminded to thank everyone who made our lives both extraordinary and ordinary. The White House staff, her teachers, her Secret Service detail, her friends' parents. She treated them all the exact same way, even heads of state. Her gratitude toward the people in her life ran deep. It led to many proud mom moments for me, as the kids would say. Over the years, I worried about Chelsea less and less as it became clear I didn't have to. I also learned from her more and more. In stressful moments, she's the calmest person in the room. She also seizes every chance to be silly with her friends and now her kids. These are the actions of someone who understands that life will throw a lot of challenges your way, and you should build up your inner resources of peace and happiness whenever you can. And as was particularly evident in the 2016 campaign, she's intrepid. Chelsea traveled far and wide campaigning for me, and she did it with Aiden, whom she was still nursing. It's like that line from the late Ann Richards, the governor of Texas. Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, just backward and in high heels. Chelsea did everything an energetic campaign surrogate would do, just with a tiny baby attached to her and all the gear that he required. She'd call me from the road to tell me everything that she was seeing and hearing. "I'm not sure we're breaking through," she said, both during the primary and the general. "It feels really hard to get the facts out." Her time on the 2016 campaign trail started with a bang. On her very first day, when she politely raised questions about Bernie's health care plan — she has a master's degree in public health and a doctorate in international relations with a focus on public health institutions, so she knows what she's talking about — she got absolutely hammered for it. I remember our conversation on the phone that night. Chelsea was frustrated with herself that her words didn't match what she knew or felt. I can empathize. She left some people with the impression that she thought Bernie wanted to get rid of all health care, an absurd notion, and of course, not what she meant or said. She felt awful, awful that she had left a false impression about anything with anyone, and especially because it was related to something that she understands and cares about deeply. I wished I could give her a big hug. Instead, we talked it out. Our conversation might seem a little different from the average mother-daughter talk, but underneath, it's a lot like anyone's. We started in problem-solving mode. We reviewed the policy and how better to talk about the differences between Bernie's plan and mine. Chelsea had been right on the specifics that day. At that stage,